Bree Bella was out there cheering for her sister. She did this by repeatedly chanting, "Come on, Nikki!" over and over and over again. I'm going to hear that in my fucking nightmares for the next month.
I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident.
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you.
Mr. Gorbachev, open this gate. Mr. Gorbachev. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
Shut up! It's business time, baby.
The Sala Monster sounds off.
My client, Brock Lesnar, conquered the street!
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
Who's that? You haven't been beat up properly! Woo!
That is Brie Bella ruining some classic American speeches. Hulk Hogan's self-imposed exile is apparently over. I saw this morning. He is making the media rounds starting on Monday. He's going to be doing a sit-down interview on Good Morning America that's already been taped. You know, it's smart. He'll be contrite. He'll probably cry. He'll do all the things you would expect him to do. He also told TMZ that he holds no hard feelings toward WWE. Well, that's good to know. And said that he would love to be Donald Trump's running mate in the presidential race. So if you are a black or Latino voter, that is the ticket for you. This is episode 398 of the Sala Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, August 30th, 2015. I am the Sala Monster. 22 years to the day that Lex Luger beat the evil foreign champion to win the championship triumphantly. No, I'm just kidding. He won by countout. They didn't know it yet, but that was the end of Luger's push. I want to thank Mish and Joey from Wrestling Soup for having me on the show. I was on their Saturday morning shitbox answering voicemails and just having a fun time on Saturday morning. So if you want to check out that show, it is up in the archives on WrestlingSoup.com. You can head over there. I know it's on their Stitcher page as well. So head on over and check that out. It's always a lot of fun hanging out with those guys. The Daniel Bryan book is still available if you want to take advantage of our free offer via Audible. You can get your Daniel Bryan audiobook free, or your Chris Jericho audiobook, or your Shawn Michaels audiobook, or your Hulk Hogan audiobook. Whatever floats your boat. All you got to do is use our URL to sign up for a 30-day trial of the service, audibletrial.com/Sala Monster. Once you go through the sign-up process, you can sample the service for a month. And if you cancel at any time, that's fine. You won't be billed in those 30 days, but you get to keep your one free audiobook that you get. So use our link, audibletrial.com/Sala Monster. I owe all you guys a thank you. We set a record last month in terms of sign-ups. And usually when that happens, you know, especially if there's an interest in like one particular new book that just came out, you know, we may drop by about half the following month, which is still pretty good. We actually bested our record from July here in August. So thank you for that. But keep signing up and taking advantage of that. You get one free book that way. Also, don't forget to check out our store on prowrestlingtees.com/Sala Monster Sounds Off. We have our Whistling Dixie shirt. 20 other t-shirts to choose from. And keep sending me those photos on Twitter whenever you're out and about wearing a shirt. I'll be happy to retweet you. And if you want to make a PayPal donation, as always, you can do so on thesalamonster.com. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname. Shout out to Russell the Muscle, Malicious Intent Michael Cuomo, Deadpool James Herrera, Devastation David Uragus, Jet Setter John Peterson, Arif the Muscle Malik, and Funtime Frederick Carter. Thank you guys very much for the support. NXT TakeOver and SummerSlam were last weekend. I have two separate reviews up on our YouTube page as Sound Off Extra, so if you didn't see it, I posted the links up on Twitter and Facebook. Not everybody is on there. Full reviews. I'm not going to get into the shows here because if you want to hear, you know, what happened and my live thoughts from being in the Barclays Center for NXT, which was an awesome show, by the way, go on the YouTube page. They're almost an hour each. I think the NXT reviews over 45 minutes. The SummerSlam reviews almost an hour. So head on over there and check that out. And always remember, whenever those Sound Off extras go up on YouTube, because people still ask me about this, I always put a link to the MP3. So if you want to right-click Save As or just click it and stream it that way, I always give you the option. But you got to go to the video, and that link is in the video description. So head on over there and hit the subscribe button on the channel if you haven't already done so, because there may be more content going up there very soon. Just quick summation of the NXT show. Awesome. Quick summation of SummerSlam. Good but disappointing. I was expecting more. I was not a fan of having two kind of fuck finishes in both main events. You know, I could have tolerated one to do it in both. I wasn't totally surprised, but I was still left disappointed when the show was over. You never want to leave your audience disappointed. So that would be the word that I would use to sum up SummerSlam for me. We did find out a few new things, though, about the network during the pay-per-view. Some new programming that's coming to the network this fall. They're going to be debuting a new all-access show similar to HBO's Hard Knocks that focuses on training at the Performance Center. They are broadcasting the MSG House Show that's going to be taking place October 3rd with Brock Lesnar. I see some of the rumors have him wrestling Bo Dallas. That has not yet been decided, so it could very easily end up being someone else. It is not locked in stone that he is wrestling Bo Dallas. I'm not even sure if Bo is actually penciled in as his opponent, so if you hear that, take it with a grain of salt. I don't think they've determined an opponent for him yet, but I would imagine if it's not Bo, it'll probably be somebody like Bo. For example, as much as I'd like to see it, I doubt we're going to get, you know, Brock Lesnar against Cesaro, although that would be a treat for the fans. But I'd almost rather them hold that off as maybe a pay-per-view match down the road, if they can boost Cesaro up a little bit more. But also on that show, the Dudley Boys are going to be on the MSG card. They came back on Raw this week. So that's going to air as a live special on October 3rd. You know, the last one did, I think, bigger numbers than any other special that they've ever done on the network aside from a pay-per-view. So I would imagine this is the second of what will be even more house shows that are aired on the network that have Brock. They're doing a Stone Cold podcast after Raw next Monday, September 7th, with Edge and Christian. I just got done talking about Christian on the podcast last week, so maybe we'll finally get a clear answer right from his own mouth about his career status and whether or not he is officially retired, as WWE claimed he was. And the final episodes of Swerved were advertised, which confirms what I had mentioned on the podcast many weeks ago. Supposedly, it is due to a lot of talent complaints, which, if you've watched the show, you can understand that, especially some poor bastard like Heath Slater, who just keeps getting, you know, pranked on and pranked on and pranked on. You got to walk around on eggshells backstage. I was talking to actually Mish and Joey about this yesterday. I'm almost hoping that what happened is, maybe on the last episode, they actually try to swerve Randy Orton. And I'd like to think that that was the death knell for the show. Like, they swerved or attempted to swerve Randy Orton. And Randy Orton, I get the impression he's the kind of guy who would not put up with that kind of shit. So who knows? Maybe they tried it, and Randy Orton was like, yeah, fuck this. This is not going to happen. And that was the end of Swerved. But, yeah, for all the people who tweeted me after they started advertising new Swerved episodes a few weeks ago, acting like a bunch of snarky jackasses, apology accepted. Tough Enough is over, which I'm sure is a relief for many people out there that this show has come to an end. Josh the Yeti, or Wookiee, or whatever the hell he's supposed to be, and Sarah Lee, they are your Tough Enough winners, each receiving a WWE contract worth $250,000. Josh beat ZZ pretty handily, 70% to 30%. I mean, this is not the first time he's beaten ZZ in the fan vote. It happened twice before. I think it was pretty obvious that Josh was winning here. Josh is the hand-picked person that Vince McMahon liked the most on the show. And wouldn't you know, Josh is the winner. And Sarah Lee beat Amanda 64-36. I still think it's a crime that Gigi didn't win for the women. But Sarah Lee, no matter how much they showed the judges or the coaches yelling at her and berating her, it only made her more of a sympathetic character. And you knew that she was winning the whole thing. There was never any doubt. The stuff with Amanda calling her a ring... And by the way, I cast my vote for Amanda during the show because I actually thought Amanda looked the part. She looked like a star more than Sarah Lee did on that final episode. And I think I even, you know, again, tweeted out a vote for her. But realistically, the outcome was never really in any doubt. I think it was more just a matter of how handily was Sarah Lee going to win. And she won pretty handily. And like I said, no matter how they tried to make Sarah Lee look on that show, it just made her that much more of a fan favorite. And the stuff with Amanda calling her a ring rat and accusing her of sleeping around, it just sealed her fate. You know, if she wasn't already done, she was pretty much, you know, toast at that point. And her saying, oh, you know, this is not me, I'm just playing a heel, I'm playing a character, this isn't really who I am, she's full of shit. You know, I'm sure they played things up to make her look like even more of a bitch than she is, because that's what these reality shows do. But it's not just, oh, I'm being a heel. You know, you were a bitch, and you paid the price for it. You know, the fans love Sarah Lee. Even Triple H on Tough Talk. He said, you know, he saw his kids backstage for like 5 minutes at SummerSlam. He was running around all day. And when he saw them, they talked about was how excited they were that they just met Sarah Lee. You know, because they had they flew the Tough Enough finalists in to be at TakeOver. They flew them in to be part of SummerSlam. And all Triple H's kids talked about was how excited they were to see the Sarah Lee girl. And Triple H said it himself, I don't get it. I don't get the appeal. But you have clearly made a connection with the fans, and that has as much to do with being successful as the in-ring stuff. You know, Amanda looked like a diva. Sarah Lee did not. But you could argue, you know, neither does Bayley. And she did pretty well for herself connecting to the crowd last weekend in Brooklyn. You know, by every measure, someone like Bayley should not fit in WWE. Because, look, I like Bayley. I think she's a beautiful girl. But she's not one of these bikini models or fitness models that WWE goes looking for. You know, she looks like the girl next door. And she got over because of her ability to connect with people. And on top of that, she's a pretty damn good wrestler. I didn't think one of the girls here looked any better than the other in there with Alicia Fox. You know, their matches weren't total disasters or anything. I do have to say, I felt bad for Sarah Lee on Tough Talk with everybody crapping all over her. I mean, everybody, all the judges, all the coaches, they all took pot shots, you know, saying, oh, if it were up to us, Amanda would have won the contract. The wrong person won. You know, and she has to stand there and take it. You know, and Amanda's like, I thought I deserved to win. If I'm Sarah Lee, I mean, politically, I know why this would be death for her to do that. But if I'm Sarah Lee, I'm like, yeah, well, you know what? It doesn't matter what you think. It matters what the fans think, and you lost. So quit your crying. I mean, shit, this girl just won $250,000, and because they're not happy that the fans voted her to win, they shit all over her and they embarrass her. You know, guess what? If you don't like the outcome, maybe you shouldn't have put it to a fan vote. You know, you're just pissy because you couldn't manipulate the fan vote the way that you wanted to. When, like you do your shitty little polls on Raw. What kind of match should John Cena and Randy Orton have? Should they have a no DQ match? Should they have a hardcore match? Or should they have an extreme rules match? You know, you have the power. Vote now. Like we're all fucking stupid. No matter how hard they tried to make this girl look bad, it didn't work. And I say good. I'm glad. They get what they deserve. Unfortunately for her, she's in for a rough ride because she's going to have a target on her back. She'll probably have heat with certain people. She's making all this money. She's not that good. You know, of course she's not that good. She's got, what, 10 weeks of training? Not everybody can pick it up in 10 weeks. You know, Kurt Angle could probably pick it up pretty good in 10 weeks. Sarah Lee is no Kurt Angle. So it's not even her fault, but you could already kind of tell that she's going to have it. She's going to have it rough. Now, on the men's side, Josh and ZZ, they had matches each with Cesaro, probably the best person they could have been in the ring with. Josh, actually, we'll start with ZZ. I mean, ZZ came out with this King of the Bayou character wearing an alligator skin as a cape. So that was kind of unique. And then it all fell apart because he took too long, and then he was rambling on the microphone to the point where they just they just cut him off and played Cesaro's music. The most impressive thing that ZZ did in his match was a leapfrog. He was gassed in the first minute. You know, Josh's match, I don't know what the hell Josh was wearing. Josh was basically just wearing his underwear. That may be okay for the women. It, you know, wasn't something I had to see. But, you know, both matches were fine for what they were. I can't say that one was that much better than the other. Maybe the Josh match was a little bit better. The people got it right. You know, between the two of them, the choice was obvious. Josh won in a landslide, and now he fades into obscurity, like most of the other Tough Enough winners that they've had. And they better hope I'm wrong, and that that's not the case. Because if they want to bring the show back at some point, they need to have at least one winner to point to as being a success story. The Miz, you could say, is a success story, but he did not win. They need a Tough Enough winner that they could point to and say, see, you know, we made a real star. And they really haven't been able to do that. They can't point to that one guy that they still have. I'm not talking about a John Morrison, somebody they still have under contract. And even when Morrison was under contract, Morrison, did Morrison win? I think Morrison won, but he was never a top guy. He could have been, but he never was elevated that high up in the food chain. So all these seasons of Tough Enough, and what do you really have to show for it? You know, you have a few people that you know, came through the system and they're still around, but they need that one guy that they could point to say, see, we made a real star who's on top, who's drawing money, who's wrestling all the big names, and they've never had that before. And that's one of the reasons that nobody takes the show seriously. I mean, it doesn't exactly have this sterling record of producing stars. I think it would be far more entertaining. Okay, and again, I talked about this with Mission Joey yesterday. I think it would be much more entertaining and a much better show if they used experienced guys from the indies and try to train them in the WWE style. So you're not just bringing in indie guys who can already work and just letting them work matches. It would be interesting to bring in a guy who maybe has, you know, 5 years of experience, 10 years of experience working on the indies, including some names that you and I would know. And try to kind of break some of those habits and train them in the WWE way of doing things. I think that would be very entertaining. And I'm talking, again, guys who also have experience doing promos, not just wrestling. And don't let the fans vote for the winner if you're just going to bury the winner because you don't like him or because you don't like her. Let the judges pick who advances and who goes home. And if you want the live fan interaction that they crave, oh, go to the app and cast your vote. Go on Twitter and use hashtag, you know what. If they love that so much, that's fine. Every reality show now wants to have some kind of fan interaction. You can still do that. You can make them feel like they're part of the show. Give them the chance to save people. The way they did it this season, each judge had one save that they could use for the entire season. The only one who never used a save was Daniel Bryan. But if you put the decision in the hands of the judges, then the fans can have one save per person. So if you're picking one male winner and one female winner, then for the season, the fans can pick one male and one female at some point that they save, whether it's, you know, whatever episode it is. I guess it wouldn't be the finale, but there's a way that you can work that out. You know, let the fans at least have a voice in that respect. But don't give them all the power if you're just going to poo-poo because you don't like the people that they're voting for every week. It's not our fault. You're the idiots who put the show together. And I'm just thinking off the top of my head here. I'm sure there's a logical way to do that. That, to me, would be the better way to go. Now, I want to talk about this Divas Revolution stuff. And I want to also promote my new partnership with John Canton, TJRWrestling.net. I have a column that's up there right now, if you haven't already seen it, on this whole Divas Revolution mess, why it's not working, some ideas on what they could do to kind of right the ship. It went up many days ago. There have been some things that have happened since then that I'll get into here in a second. But I want to just thank John for giving me the forum to get that up. And there will be future columns going up as well. So TJRWrestling.net, the John Report, that's the place to go to check out my latest column. So here's the deal with the Divas. We saw, in my opinion, the greatest women's match in the history of that company at NXT TakeOver last Saturday. It was an amazing experience to be there live in that building for everything from start to finish. From the video package that aired before the match, to the entrances and the big balloon men and the Escalade, the match itself, the post-match stuff. The only thing it was missing was pyro and confetti. It was awesome. Everybody was on such a high in the building when that match was over. I've already gone back and watched the match four times since. I don't remember the last match I did that for. It might have been John Cena and CM Punk at Money in the Bank. It's been a long-ass time since I've done that, let alone for a women's match. And then we had SummerSlam. We had the big 9-diva elimination three-way Team Bad and Team PCB and Team Bella. And Team PCB got the win. Not the greatest reaction to the women, but, you know, given their placement on the show and the fact that you just had 9 bodies out there for no real reason, you know, look, I could see why. And plus, I think they put that match on after the championship match with Cena and Rollins, which was an excellent match, save for the finish. So it wasn't an ideal situation for them to be in, but nevertheless, it wasn't a terrible match. And then on Raw, everything just went straight to hell. There was a Miz TV segment that set up a 6-diva tag team match that the fans turned on. They crapped all over it. They showed no respect whatsoever for anybody in the ring or anything that was going on. And then Paige had a meltdown on social media afterwards. She went on Twitter and she said, "You helped us create change, and then you did your best to disrespect. Nice job." A tweet, by the way, that she then deleted. Brie Bella went on Instagram and told the Brooklyn fans to kiss her ass. Her sister, Busty Bella, went on Instagram and said, "Shame on you fans for disrespecting the women that put their bodies on the line for your entertainment." When I tweeted, "This is why we can't have nice things" on Monday during the Divas match, I was referring to the stupid "We Are Awesome" chants, which were cute the first time it happened the night after WrestleMania 29. I was in the building for that too. It was a lot of fun to crap all over Sheamus and Randy Orton. Was it disrespectful? Yeah, sure. But you had a building full of European fans who were there to just have a good time. They were starting all kinds of chants and soccer chants all night long, and everybody was into it by the end. All night long, it felt like a party atmosphere. For all the disrespectful chants, they also made fandangoing a thing that night, so, you know, it wasn't a total loss. Now, "We Are Awesome" is not fun. It is not funny. It's narcissistic and stupid. But if you're Paige, or if you're the Bella Twins, you don't go on Twitter, you don't go on Instagram, and bitch about it. Especially Paige, who did the old tweet and delete. She never should have tweeted that in the first place, because all that does is show people that you let it get to you. And what it does is it encourages idiots in other cities to start doing the same thing. I don't think Paige wants this to become a weekly occurrence. So she should have kept her mouth shut. But I can't lay all the blame on the fans for what happened. If you just blame the fans, you're ignoring a much larger problem, which is why this whole Divas Revolution is sputtering so badly. The blame lays on Vince McMahon. How many times do we hear people say the buck stops with Vince? Vince has the final say. It doesn't make TV without Vince's approval. The guy's in every production meeting. He's back there with a headset on his head every single week telling the announcers what to say and when to say it. Producing the show. He is right smack dab in the middle of everything. So whoever may be coming up with ideas for the women, it doesn't matter. That's on Vince. If somebody pitches a bad idea, he has the power to stop it and say, "Hey, your idea sucks." I don't know who thought it would be a good idea to bring up the women and assign them to random factions and then put them all in tag team matches every single week. But whoever did should have their creative privileges revoked. Now, on Monday, it started with this god-awful Miz TV segment. They had Team PCB out there. And by the way, I learned that the Four Horsemen were a WWE faction. I had not been aware of that. That one comment alone made Charlotte look like such an idiot. And her own father was in the damn group. So, you know, we were off to a rip-roaring start here with this dialogue. Then we have Paige yakking on about how we are now in the era of the female athlete. Nobody wants to hear about this. We want to hear that, hey, there's only a few weeks left before Nikki Bella surpasses AJ Lee as the longest reigning Divas champion of all time, and I want a match with her so I could take the title off of her. You know, AJ's a friend of Paige, no? Last time we saw the two of them together, they were partners at WrestleMania against the Bella Twins. Why is Paige not talking about that? No, they talk about the era of the female athlete and how this is a revolution. Nobody cares. It's not a revolution just because you say it is. And then you have Becky Lynch. She's out there saying some wacky things because I guess her gimmick now is that she's supposed to be the crazy one. Then they're out there doing their little pinky swear thing. That's almost as bad as having a butterfly belt and calling them divas. Yeah, they talk about Ronda Rousey and they talk about Serena Williams. If you handed Ronda Rousey a belt that looked like that after one of her fights, she would rip your arm off and beat you over the head with it. And that's one of the biggest problems. They, you know, they love to say Ronda Rousey and Serena Williams and the U.S. women's soccer team, but they don't realize that what drives those women, why they do what they do, is winning. They compete to win. Ronda Rousey is obsessed with retiring undefeated. It is so important to her that she's able to do that. And she's talked about how once she's able to get that fight with Cyborg, she's going to beat Cyborg and she's going to retire undefeated. And I don't know if she's actually going to retire at that point or not, because money talks. But that's what drives her. A title, a trophy, whatever. In this Divas Revolution, winning doesn't seem as important as talking about it. And in fact, Nikki Bella came out and said exactly that. That winning and losing doesn't matter. All that matters is that in 2 weeks, she's going to break the record. That's what she said. Your own champion is on TV admitting that wins and losses don't matter. Becky Lynch won the match for her team at SummerSlam. Who cares? And she's right. It doesn't matter. Which is why in the very next segment, when they had yet another tag team match, the fans crapped all over it. And as much as I hated some of those chants, you can almost understand why. When The Miz tells the women, when my hand goes up, your mouth goes shut, and the people cheer, that's a problem. So now that we've established that Paige doesn't care about the title or preserving her friend's record, and that Becky's win at SummerSlam didn't matter, and Sasha Banks making the Divas Champion tap out the week before on live TV isn't even worthy of a mention on this week's show. It's like it never happened. I mean, I get Sasha not being on the show, I guess, because she was still sore from the match at TakeOver. She did still do a dive out of the ring at SummerSlam, so she couldn't have been that beat up. I saw that Instagram video of the reverse Rana in the Bayley match, and Sasha's very lucky she's not in a wheelchair right now. It was very scary to watch. But if none of these things matter, why should we care? Why even book a champion versus champion match last week if you were just going to treat it like an afterthought? They did that shit all the time when they still had that World Heavyweight title, and I was so glad when they got rid of that thing. Here's what they need to do. First, stop with this Divas Revolution nonsense. Nobody is buying it. The fans resent it when you tell us something that we know isn't true. So just stop. Second, stop with the random tag team matches every week and come up with some stories for these women. I still like my idea of taking two or three writers from the staff of 30 that they have and assigning them to focus on nothing but the women. That's their only job. Learn everything you can about them, talk to them, interview them, maybe even solicit some ideas from them if they have any, and then go back to the writer's room and come up with some ideas for them that are compelling, that people are actually going to care about. That should be their only job. Those two or three people, at least one of which, by the way, should be a woman. I know they have, or they've had in the past, female writers. At least one of them should be a woman, because maybe part of the problem is you have nothing but men, and a lot of old men probably at that, trying to come up with ideas for all these women. Get a female perspective in there, and make that their sole focus. And here's the third thing. As of the 15th of September, Nikki Bella breaks AJ's record. Now, personally, I don't care. I mean, what does it really matter anyway when the champion hardly ever defends the thing on TV? But that doesn't mean they shouldn't make it a big deal. She's still been champion for a long-ass time. They just announced a beat-the-clock challenge for Raw this Monday with Team PCB, with the winner getting a title shot at Night of Champions, which is a step in the right direction. They're on the right path by doing that. The idea that I pitched in my column before they made this announcement was a triple threat match on Raw this Monday with all three members of PCB, with the winner getting the title shot the following week on Raw. So this idea that they have here is not too far off from what I had pitched. Except, it sounds like, if that September 15th date is accurate, and I believe it is, they're just going to let Nikki break the record without building any drama around it. I think that is a huge mistake. Now, unless they're just going to ignore that date and pretend that it didn't actually happen until after Night of Champions. Look, that wouldn't be the first time that they had revisionist history. So even if the record technically is broken, I think the record is, what, 295 days? I think as of the 15th, that would be day number 296. If most people don't even know that, WWE could just go on TV and say, oh, if Nikki Bella can escape Night of Champions with her title, she'll break the record, and they can just bump it back a week. Maybe that's what they're doing. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe that September 15th date is wrong, but I'm pretty sure that is the date. If it is, they should be doing the title match on Raw the week before the pay-per-view and building that match up all night long. If ever there was a time to take a chance on a Divas main event on Raw, that would be it. And I've talked about that here on the podcast before. Divas Revolution. You know what would be pretty revolutionary? To put the women on last. How many times in Raw's history has that happened? Maybe twice? I know it's 6 days before a pay-per-view. They'd probably want to have Sting and Rollins out there for the final segment. But people hate the Bellas so much. If they knew that record and they knew that title was on the line, I really think it would get the crowd totally amped up to see this woman lose. And she doesn't even have to lose. I wouldn't even necessarily book her to lose. You know, Paige could be the one who gets the title shot, you know, for Team PCB. And you have Becky and Charlotte when she's just inches away from winning the championship. They interfere and they cost her the title. Purely out of jealousy. That's something that female fans, I think, can relate to. That's why they watch so many soap operas and reality shows. So that opens Paige up all of a sudden to have matches for however many weeks with Charlotte and Becky. And it opens up Nikki Bella, who now sets the record, to feud with Sasha Banks for the championship, because Sasha tapped her out on television last week. Or the week before. You know, let's get some real stories out of this. And I said this on Wrestling Soup. Do you realize the only two women in that company with a real story right now, and it's not a great one, it's entertaining enough. I have warmed up to the whole, you know, Rusev Ziggler storyline, but the only women with a story right now are Lana and Summer Rae. Two women who aren't even wrestling matches. That's pathetic. Mickey and Trish back in the day had a story. Mickey James was a psycho superfan who was so obsessed with Trish Stratus, she built a goddamn shrine to the woman. Literally, built a shrine to her. She lost her mind. And now, she wanted Trish's title. And it worked, because it was so different than anything we had seen on Raw up to that point. You know, back then it was all bikini models and lip injections and big fake tits, and nobody knew really how to wrestle. They weren't there to wrestle. They were there to be sex objects. Although I have to say, in her defense, I was not a Candice Michelle fan. until the end of her run in WWE, because she actually tried very hard and she got better and became a pretty decent performer. So I give her credit. But Trish and Mickey, at the time, it was just a breath of fresh air. I was looking more forward to that match at WrestleMania 22 than any other match on that card. That was a story that worked. It wasn't, hey, let's put Trish together with Victoria and Jackie Gata in tag team matches every week against Mickey and Jazz, and I can't even think of another heel diva from 2006, but you get my drift. That wasn't going to work. It was one-on-one, and it was all about the championship. It's so simple. It's so simple. Yeah, I've never come on the show before and said, oh, what these people do is so easy that I could do it all myself. I know their jobs are very hard. I know they work a lot of hours. They have a very demanding boss. I get that. But they're taking a hard job and they're making it unnecessarily harder. This should not be complicated. They can fix the diva stuff very easily if they really wanted to. I don't think they care enough. I think Triple H and Stephanie care. But Triple H and Stephanie are not the ones riding Raw every week. So I've just outlined a whole bunch of things they could do to steer things in the right direction. I hope somebody there is listening to this. I hope somebody is listening to the people at that takeover show and how they reacted to the women's title match. Because I saw people, tears in their eyes when Bayley won that championship. These weren't little kids. These were grown adults crying because someone won a wrestling belt. How the same company responsible for that can also be responsible for what we saw on Monday is a mystery to me. But it's proof they can do it if they want to. They are more than capable of doing it the right way. The beat the clock stuff this week, it's a step in the right direction. But like I said, it's a big mistake if they don't play off Nikki breaking that record. She's held the thing this long. You may as well build some drama around it. Raw Monday Night was live from the Barclays Center in Brooklyn for the third straight night, third straight sellout. Diva stuff aside, this was a pretty enjoyable show, very newsworthy. The Dudley Boys are back to feud with New Day for the tag team titles. There is a new third member of the Wyatt family, and Sting will now challenge Seth Rollins for the WWE title at Night of Champions. And boy, does that make the outcome of that match with Triple H at WrestleMania look even dumber than it already was. Brock Lesnar and Paul Heyman were out for the beginning of this show. They wanted The Undertaker. Undertaker was not there. He flew home after the pay-per-view on Sunday. They got Bo Dallas instead. Hardly a suitable substitute. If this were a house show, people would be demanding a refund. He was happy to see Brock had woken up after Undertaker put him to sleep the night before and said that he had sweet dreams, like what it would be like to actually beat The Undertaker. All Brock had to do is believe. So Brock murdered him in cold blood, picked him up, tossed him around for a few suplexes. Brock went to leave. Heyman talked him into going back and giving him another. And then he told him, eh, give him just an F5. And Brock obliged. This was fun. New Day came out with Xavier Woods playing New York, New York on the trombone. Fans chanted New Day rocks, even though they acted appalled like they were chanting New Day sucks. I was waiting in line outside the Barclays Center for NXT on Saturday. NXT, okay? Not SummerSlam, not Raw, NXT. A show the New Day wasn't even on. And all you heard every few minutes outside were chants of New Day rocks! New Day rocks! These guys are beloved. They beat the Lucha Dragons with the primetime players out there doing commentary. They didn't have much to say. As they were celebrating their victory, the Dudley Boys' old pyro went off and out walked Bubba and Devon to a massive response. Part of why it was so massive is because this was such a well-kept secret. I give them a lot of credit. I didn't hear anything about even the possibility of the Dudleys coming back on this show. It was a genuine surprise. The first genuine surprise on Raw in a long, long time. It's very rare these days that WWE is able to keep something a secret. But when they do, you end up getting a reaction like this. JBL did his shtick where he runs down all of their accomplishments on commentary, which I hate. He almost ruined Sting's debut by doing that. It's like these guys showed up unexpectedly. It's a huge surprise. It's a huge shock to everybody. You know, but hey, let's talk about all the championships that Sting won in the NWA and the PWA and the WWA and, like, shut up. You know? Just call him one of the greatest tag teams of all time and let the crowd reaction speak for itself. You can rattle off all their accomplishments next week. It's one of those little things that just annoys me about his commentary. You know, Sting at Survivor Series was by far the worst. It was like he was trying to read his entire resume before he made it down to the ring. Like nobody would know who this man was. So the Dudleys beat up the New Day, gave him the was up headbutt off the top, put Xavier Woods through a table with the 3D. A triumphant return for these two men. Both in much better shape than the last time we saw them together in WWE. They look like they have not aged a bit since then. And what it does, it helps invigorate the tag team division, because all of a sudden you have a bunch of very unique matchups that you can do. Dudley's and New Day is the first one that they're going to go with. They tease the Dudley's and the Primetime Players at the end of the segment. They went face-to-face. You could do the Dudley's and the Wyatt family, whatever iteration of the Wyatts you want to go with. Last we saw of Harper and Rowan as a tag team, they were using the 3D, and Bubba was taking him to task for it on Twitter, almost teasing that they were coming in for a feud, and then nothing ever happened. And I wonder, looking back on it now, I wonder if that was the plan. I wonder if the plan was for the Dudleys to come back months ago, but then Rowan got hurt, and everything kind of went up in the air. That the timeline sounds about right on that. So I'm thinking Rowan's injury probably had something to do with the Dudleys not coming back until now. You could also, you know, Jey Uso is due back any month now, so you could do the Dudleys and the Usos. People have kind of forgotten about them. How about the Dudleys against the Shield? Roman Reigns and Dean Ambrose, I'd be down for that. So with them being back, lots of possibilities, so I give this a thumbs up. We got a glimpse of the bronze Rollins statue that the Authority had promised him if he would have come out of SummerSlam with both championships, which he did. And they were going to present this statue to him at the end of the show. It looked unfinished. At least the U.S. title over his shoulder did. We never did get to see that statue unveiled. So I wonder if maybe it'll end up defaced or destroyed at some point in the next few weeks, kind of like J&J's car. We all know what happened to that car. We got a Reigns and Ambrose versus Wyatt family rematch from SummerSlam. Why? Because fuck you, that's why. There was no reason to do a rematch. It was a pretty clean, decisive win for the good guys, but they did it anyway. They beat the Wyatts fair and square the night before, but I guess it never happened. So Reigns and Ambrose again had the Wyatts beaten when all of a sudden the lights went out, and when they came back on, a gigantic man in a black sheet mask was standing on the apron. He took the mask off to reveal himself as Ogre from Revenge of the Nerds, or not, but he did look like Ogre. Or Ted Arcidi with a beard. He proceeded to slaughter Reigns and Ambrose. Nothing they did had any effect on this guy. It was like the first time The Undertaker tried to go toe-to-toe with the Giant Gonzalez. He towered over Roman Reigns and Dean Ambrose. He made Ambrose especially. He made him look like a midget. He put both of them in a standing head and neck choke, and then the Wyatt family stood tall. Once again, three members deep. Poor Eric Rowan. So the guy's name. The guy's name is Braun Strowman. He is billed at 6'8", 385 pounds. He looks every bit of that. He is just enormous. He has been with NXT for about 2 years, never appeared on television except as one of Adam Rose's Rosebuds. So if you look familiar, besides him looking like Ogre from Revenge of the Nerds, that's probably where you recognize him from. I've never seen him wrestle before, so the jury is out on whether or not he can go in the ring. He can stand there and look big and mean, but can he wrestle? That I don't know. All I heard before Eric Rowan debuted on TV was how horrible he was in the ring. And, yeah, I mean, he wasn't great or anything like that, but he more than held his own. Eric Rowan was fine. This guy may turn out to be just fine, but there's probably a reason he never wrestled on NXT television before, I'm guessing. So I guess Roman Reigns and Dean Ambrose need a partner now. We know it won't be Sting. That had been the rumor for many weeks. That actually may have been the plan, but plans change. So it ain't going to be him. I say why not Cesaro? You know, he lost to Kevin Owens at SummerSlam. He's not challenging for the championship anytime soon. He is freakishly strong, so he could probably do things in the ring with Strowman that nobody else can do. Probably would be good for Strowman to work with a guy like Cesaro. And it gives something for Cesaro to do instead of just hanging around. I don't want to see the guy just kind of fade into the background if they have nothing for him. At least this would be something meaningful for him to be part of. So if I have a vote, which I don't, my vote would go to Cesaro. And not Cesaro, ooh, he's the third Shield member and, you know, coming out with a vest and all that kind of stuff. Just, you know, he's their partner. He steps up and says, hey, I'll help you guys out. And he can fill that role, I think, he's more than capable of filling that role. We then had the Divas disaster. I've already said my piece on this. Stardust and Barrett were out for a tag team match when Stardust suddenly attacked Barrett, I guess, for losing the night before and costing their team the win against Neville and Stephen Amell. Neville came out to make the save, but Stardust escaped. Barrett is now off to film a WWE movie, so he will be gone for a while. We then had Jon Stewart out to explain his actions at SummerSlam when he cost John Cena the United States Championship and the WWE Championship. He came out to chant of thank you, Stewart, as predicted by one of our listeners on the SummerSlam review that I did on YouTube. I cited this guy. I said this guy thinks that Stewart on Raw will explain his rationale for costing Cena the match. It had nothing to do with trying to help Rollins win, but he did it because he could not bear to see John Cena tie Ric Flair's record of 16 world championships, and that's exactly what happened. John Cena said he couldn't stand back and watch John Cena tie the record of the greatest of all time. So yes, John Stewart was every wrestling fan all over the world running into that ring and shoving that chair in Cena's gut last Sunday. Doesn't make it any less of a goofy finish for your winner-take-all match to end that way, but at least it made sense based on how Stewart was talking earlier in the show when he was going back and forth with Paul Heyman at SummerSlam. If you remember, he was talking about how big of a wrestling fan he was, so at least in that respect, it kind of made sense. Ric Flair came out and told Jon Stewart that what he did was wrong. He said he wants John Cena to tie the record, thus turning heel, Ric Flair. Because he knows the record is going to be broken one day anyway. He would rather it be broken by somebody that he respects. And suddenly Jon Stewart was like, what have I done? That brought out John Cena, who at least was selling anger over what happened. He wasn't smiling. He wasn't happy. He seemed more upset that he lost the U.S. title and that Rollins now had both belts, as opposed to being upset that he didn't win world title number 16. And probably because, let's be honest, like the rest of us, he knows it's inevitable, whether it happens this year or next year. It's happening, so get ready. And he then gave Jon Stewart an AA, and he left. Randy Orton, Cesaro, Ziggler, and Ryback beat Sheamus, Kevin Owens, Rusev, and The Big Show when Randy Orton pinned Sheamus with an RKO. So, what the hell was the point of Sheamus winning at SummerSlam? Why have Randy Orton get his win back the very next night? Because fuck you, that's why. After the match, the babyfaces gorilla pressed the Big Show into the air, which is pretty impressive, so that Randy Orton could give him an RKO. This actually came off as bullying to me, because the way it worked is Randy Orton wins the match. The way it went down is Big Show accidentally nailed Sheamus with a knockout punch, which led to the RKO finish. So now Kevin Owens and Rusev are all up in Big Show's face, like, what happened? What'd you do? You cost us the match, you big dummy. And the Big Show kind of shoved each, he kind of swatted them each away. He may have punched one of them in the face, I don't remember. It almost came off like a face turn. I do believe that this was Big Show's 67th turn here on this show. We just didn't realize it at the time. So they do that, and meanwhile, all the babyfaces are outside the ring plotting and circling the ring like heels would do, and they go inside, and they beat on the Big Show after the match is already over. So they came off as total bullies here, but the fans were cheering them. Then again, it was Brooklyn, so they would cheer people like that. Triple H and Stephanie had John Cena kicked out of the building. Shout out to Mike Verna, who played one of the security guards that escorted Cena out of there. He was in the match at that indie show when I had my knees smashed on that Five Borough Wrestling show. And he has vowed to get revenge on Stockade for me at the next show. He is teaming up with Kevin Nash against Stockade and a partner. So hopefully I will be there to see him kick his ass. It was then time for the statue unveiling. First, Triple H and Stephanie broke script to sing Happy Birthday to Vince McMahon, who turned 70 on Monday, in case you couldn't tell by his creative sensibility. There was a giant box in the ring, presumably covering the statue before the big reveal. But first, Seth Rollins cut one of his long, 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 long promos that really was about probably about 15 minutes, or felt like 15 minutes, had no business being more than 5. I just sort of tuned them out at this point because he never has anything particularly interesting to say. So finally they lift the box up and it was Sting, missing half his face paint, no doubt from all the face palming he was doing as he stood in that box waiting for Rollins to shut up. Sting clotheslined Rollins out of the ring and posed with the WWE title to end the show. It was a cool moment. They announced after the show that Sting, whose record in WWE is 0-1, would get the next championship match against Rollins at Night of Champions. So yes, this makes no sense. Nothing they've done with Sting thus far has really made much sense. But Rollins is really the best possible opponent for him. I don't think they're going to pull a bait and switch. People have asked me about this, where Sting beats Rollins, but it ends up that he won the U.S. title and not the WWE title. I don't think that's going to happen. I think Rollins ends up pulling double duty on that show against Cena for the U.S. title and then Sting later in the night for the WWE title. I mean, I guess they could go with a triple threat match, but I don't think they will. I think Rollins wrestles twice, and I think Sting absolutely has a chance of beating him for that championship. Maybe Sheamus cashes in after and beats Sting for the title. I think that would be horrible. I do not want to see Sheamus with that title, let alone beating Sting. Maybe they give him a short token run with it like they did with Hogan in 2002. I mean, there is a precedent for this. There is a precedent for this. Hogan beat Triple H a month after Triple H won the championship in this great comeback story. Remember that? He was out with the quad tear. 8 months he was gone. He comes back, jacked to the gills, wins the Royal Rumble, goes to WrestleMania, wins the Undisputed Championship, and then 1 month later, he loses it to 50-year-old Hulk Hogan. And Hogan was really just a transitional champion. They got the title off him the month after. They put it on The Undertaker. I could see them doing something similar with Sting, and him dropping it back to Rollins maybe in October at Hell in a Cell. They've already announced that Sting is going to open Raw this Monday night. We'll see what his rationale is for showing up now. You know, before it was to kill the authority, and he failed. Not only did he fail, he shook hands with Triple H when the match was over. Now he's back to make Triple H's life miserable. So let's see them try to explain their way out of this one. But a good episode of Raw. Aside from the Divas debacle, I thought this was a good episode. There was enough there to keep my interest, which these days is really all I can ask for with a 3-hour show.
I'm actually not wearing pants, and that's how I watch NXT every single week.
You can check out my full NXT TakeOver Brooklyn review on YouTube. Greatest women's match ever contested inside a WWE ring. I stand by that. I know sometimes people will see something great and they'll say, oh, that was the greatest of all time, and they're exaggerating, or they go back a week later and they're like, well, maybe it wasn't that great, but it was still pretty good. No, I stand by that. This was the greatest piece of business with the women that this company has ever produced. They should be proud of it. They should hold it up as something to strive for with the women going forward, because if they could get people as invested in those characters on Raw the way they did Sasha and Bayley in this match, then the Divas could really be something special. And right now they're not on the main roster anyway. But that match was fantastic. And it was great to see the wacky wailing arm flailing inflatable tube men live and in person in Brooklyn. I enjoyed that a lot. Although I think she had them in San Jose too, at the NXT show I went to over WrestleMania weekend. Always love seeing the inflatable tube men. And in fact, what was so great, one of the greatest things about that video package, it was such a great video. If you didn't see it, go find it. They had a picture of the four horsewomen. That's what they call themselves. Sasha, Charlotte, Becky, and Bailey. And so there's a photo of them standing next to each other, and they show each of the other women turning on Bailey, which I think all of them did. They all pretty much turned on Bailey at one point or another on NXT. And then making their debut on the main roster, and by the end of it, the image of Bailey, it's like that photo in Back to the Future where his family members start to disappear. Bailey vanishes. She's like cropped out of the photo. And they show the wacky tube men, and her music dies, and the tube men get deflated, and they fall to the ground. One of the most heartbreaking things I've ever seen. It was so great. Oh, I can't say enough good things about that match. But yeah, go on YouTube and check out my full review. Some other NXT notes. Jushin Thunder Liger is not yet done with WWE. He will be working more dates beyond his match with Tyler Breeze at TakeOver. They also had the president of New Japan was backstage at SummerSlam. Ghetto was there, who's the booker, or one of the bookers. Okada was there. Nakamura was there. There was actually a photo of, actually two photos of Okada. One with Finn Balor and the NXT title, and then one up in the skybox during SummerSlam with Samoa Joe and Aiden English creeping in the background. So anyway, all the New Japan guys were there visiting since they were in town for the Ring of Honor show. I don't think it's evidence of any kind of relationship between the two promotions, but it's still pretty cool to see Okada there at a WWE show. Now, would I want to see Okada in a WWE ring? Only in a perfect world where the two companies could work together and have some kind of talent exchange. That would be pretty cool. Of course, that'll never happen. Would I want to see Okada leave New Japan to go to WWE? No. No, because they'd fuck him up. The Dusty Rhodes Tag Team Classic has been announced, starting on next week's episode of NXT. Ends on the October 7th TakeOver special. I don't know what's on the line, if it's for a trophy, if it's just going to be an annual thing like the Royal Rumble or King of the Ring. I didn't read any spoilers. I did see that Samoa Joe and Finn Balor were one of the teams in this tournament, so this is going to involve everyone, not just the usual tag teams on NXT. Next week, they have announced Baron Corbin and Rhino against The Ascension. Yeah, they're still around, believe it or not. Actually, I think they didn't they put them in the ring with the Dudleys on SmackDown? I didn't see SmackDown, but I think in the results, I think they went up against the Dudleys. So, in fact, the Ascension is still around. I don't know why, but they are. They announced their first NXT UK tour, December 10th through December 16th, and that show on the 16th from London is going to be a live TakeOver special, which means it's going to be airing on a Wednesday afternoon here in the States. That's 2 TakeOver shows in 2 months. Usually they go about 3 months between shows. And so between that and the fact that they're running all big buildings in the UK, they're not running any small venues like Royal Albert Hall or anything like that. They're running big buildings. All of this goes to that question I asked last week. Is NXT growing too fast? As long as they're selling out, which they are, and they're making money, yeah, the answer is no. But I do still wish they would run some of the more intimate venues for these big shows, save the big arenas maybe for just a handful of times each year. I do think it loses something by always being in big buildings now. Japanese wrestling star Kana is rumored to have been signed to a WWE contract. I had no idea who this woman was before last weekend. Apparently she's very popular in Japan. She's also competed in Shimmer before here in the States. They would not have showed her on camera the way they did a TakeOver. So let me just set the stage here. So at TakeOver, at various points, to make this show look like a big deal, they would do cutaways. First of all, being in the building, it was weird to me that entire front row on the hard camera side was empty, because it's a sold-out building, and why wouldn't you have people in the front row? Well, the reason they left it empty was so that they can bring in the NWO, right? They showed Hall and Nash and X-Pac on camera, and they make it seem like everybody's just sitting around, having a good time. They show them on camera. They bring them over so they could show them on camera, and as soon as the camera goes off, they leave. So they would bring guys out, show them on camera, and out they went. And then a few segments later, all of a sudden, there's Ric Flair and Sergeant Slaughter, and there's this Asian woman that I've never seen before. And honest to God, at first when I saw this, I thought to myself, is that Ric Flair's new girlfriend? Because she was standing right next to him. And then when the camera came off them and they left, she was right with him as they left the the arena. They left together. And it's Ric Flair, so naturally I'm thinking, okay, I see he's moved on from Fifi the Maid to someone younger. But apparently that's not the case. But they would not have shown her on camera the way they did, and they flashed her name up on the screen with an extra N. Apparently it's spelled K-A-N-A, but on camera they showed K-A-N-N-A, which is usually what they do when they've signed somebody and they want to change their name. Okay, either that or Kevin Dunn is just dyslexic. But I'm pretty sure she's signed to a contract, so it's good. It's good to see them bringing in some international talent to spice up that women's division. I mean, they're calling up a lot of different people, and you've got to have other people who are capable of kind of stepping in their place when you do that. All right, so this week's TV. No major edits from what I saw live in the building. I guess there wasn't much that could be done about that botched finish in the main event. When I saw it live, I was 100% certain, even from one of the upper levels of the building, that was not the planned finish in the Fatal 4-Way with Charlotte, Becky Lynch, Emma, and Dana Brooke. The finish was Emma delivering an Emma sandwich in the corner to Becky Lynch, and then just pinning her. And you could tell the confusion when the referee hit three. Everybody looked confused, everybody looked shocked, the fans were shocked, everybody was shocked. So I was 100% sure watching that live in the building that somebody fucked up. And then watching it back on TV, now I'm 120% positive that that was not the planned finish. It's the only way that Emma will ever win a big match on TV, is by accident. This show was an hour and 15 minutes, and it really didn't have to be an hour and 15 minutes. There was a lot of filler between these matches. Some of it was good, a lot of it was just unnecessary. I already went through the spoiler results in my TakeOver review on YouTube, so I'm not going to spend much time on this. The reaction that Kaz and Enzo got when they made their entrance for that 8-man tag was insane. Unless they're getting called up, they really missed the boat not putting the belts on these guys here, or at least having them on that TakeOver special. All night long, even during SummerSlam, you could kind of hear it. But even during the TakeOver special that they were not on, all you heard was chants of, how you doing? How you doing? All night long, how you doing? I don't know how I'm doing. I'm doing all right. Eva Marie, what more can be said? They hated her guts in Brooklyn. You would think it was Mayor de Blasio out there. Actually, I think Eva Marie would probably get a better reaction than Mayor de Blasio would, and rightfully so. Her and Carmella together, like I said last week, this was going to be the blind leading the blind out there, and that's pretty much what this was. Eva won with the sliced bread, made hand motions after the match around her waist like she was going to go for the championship. And in their mind, they probably think putting the title on her soon would get her so much heat. Oh, she would be such a heel. People would hate her so much. She would get so much heel heat if we put the championship on her. I think that would be death for what they created on NXT with these women. The fans have certain expectations of these women on that brand now, more so than the main roster. They've really created something special, and they would kill it. They would kill it in an instant if they put that title on that woman. I hope that's not what they're planning on doing, but I have a feeling that Eva ain't losing a match until she wins that championship. Since she came back, she's only had two or three matches. She's undefeated, and I think it's going to stay that way probably until they put the title on her, which means we're probably not too far off from that happening. I mean, realistically, maybe they'll do a Bayley-Sasha Banks rematch at some point, but who does Bayley feud with next? If you consider that Charlotte and Sasha and Becky really are not going to be on NXT much anymore, then who does Bayley defend the title against next? Carmella? No. Alexa Bliss? Probably not. But Eva Marie, right? She's the one getting the big push. She may well be the next challenger for that title. And here's the biggest problem with Eva Marie, and I said this in the YouTube review. Her biggest problem, among many, is that she moves in slow motion, like she's underwater. She's so tentative in everything she does, every movement, it just looks bad. It just does not look good. Tyler Breeze vowed that things were not over between him and Jushin Thunder Liger. He had a bigger idea that he was going to run by William Regal, and he emphasized the word bigger. I don't know what that means. Maybe they're going to give him a bodyguard. But we'll see. Actually, they may well be doing that. There's so many similarities between him and Shawn Michaels when Shawn Michaels started his heel run in 92. It wouldn't shock me at all, actually, if they were going to put a bodyguard with him. The best part of the show was Bayley's backstage promo at TakeOver after she had just won the championship. She was in tears. It was real, genuine emotion. She talked about the four horsewomen and being sad that they were on the main roster and not her. She really wanted them to always be around. Then they brought her family into the shot. Her mom cut a promo and was actually quite good at putting over how proud she was of her daughter. And then Bayley cut her mom off and said that she was talking too much. I wish we could send Bayley out there on Raw whenever Seth Rollins comes out for a promo. We had a vignette for Nia Jax, who is coming soon. Another new diva coming soon to NXT. She is the Rock's cousin, and she looks just like Tamina. Looks like they may be setting her up to be the monster female on NXT. So maybe she's the next one who challenges Bayley for the championship. Apollo Crews was filmed backstage after his debut at TakeOver. All smiles, just happy to be there. Sounded like he said he was celebrating his 20th birthday that day, which didn't sound right to me. And then I checked online, and he made his debut in 2009. So unless he's been working indie since he was 14, he ain't 20 years old. He did just turn 28. So I think he just said it really, really fast, and it sounded like he said 20. Backstage interviews with Blake and Murphy and Alexa Bliss. Alexa was pissed at Blue Pants and said that next week she was going to send her back to the clearance rack. It's so bad it's good, actually. That was actually not a bad line. And then we had the women's four-way. Emma, Dana Brooke, Charlotte, and Becky Lynch. Whatever makeup Dana Brooke was wearing, she looked horrible. She should not ever do that again. Charlotte spent most of the match laying on the floor outside the ring while the heels double-teamed Becky on the inside. Match ended with Emma delivering an Emma sandwich to Becky in the corner, and she covered her, and the ref counted three. And when she got this pin, she looked as shocked as everybody else in the building, like she couldn't believe she had just won a match. You know your career is going well when even you are stunned to get your arm raised. But she did. I don't know if Becky was supposed to kick out and just forgot, if she got knocked loopy on the Emma sandwich, if Dana Brooke was supposed to break up the pin, which is very possible given that she's the one with the least amount of experience in there. You know, I don't know, but it was very apparent somebody fucked up. Charlotte, and in WWE, the referees are instructed to call it like a shoot. So in a situation like that, you don't blame the referee if no one gets the shoulder up, if nobody is coming over to break up the pin, you're supposed to call it like a shoot. And I know for a period of time, I remember reading, and this was a few years ago, that referees were actually bonused for doing that. So it was almost like an incentive to call these matches like they were legitimate fights. Charlotte, the sore loser that she is, laid out Emma after the match with a spear. Natural selection before covering her for the phantom pin. There was no referee. The fans counted 1, 2, 3. Charlotte then looked down at Emma and said, "I don't even need a referee." Okay. Dana attacked Charlotte. Becky attacked Dana. Charlotte put Dana in the figure eight. Becky put Emma in the disarmer, and they played the babyfaces music to end the show. I'm going to assume that Charlotte was probably supposed to get the win here since Becky got the win at SummerSlam the next night. They could turn this into a positive by actually, I don't know, pushing Emma and giving her a title shot next instead of Eva Marie or Nia Jax or anybody else. Emma is the one person who actually it would make sense for her now to feud with Bayley for the championship. They had an issue before. You know, Emma and Dana Brooke were bullying Bayley, and I think they were actually responsible for her hand injury, I think they said. And then Bayley had to beat Emma first, and then she beat Charlotte, and then she beat Becky to get the title shot at Sasha Banks. So they've already done the match, but with this win and with their history, it would make sense to go with Bayley and Emma next for the championship. I don't think that's what they're going to do. I think they're going to try to put this match in their rearview mirror and pretend that it never happened. So as much as I'd like to see it, I won't hold my breath on that. I haven't mentioned anything about TNA in recent weeks because there really isn't anything new to say. There's nothing new on the TNA Destination America situation, but not looking good. Discovery, which owns Destination America, has already started pulling Impact off of some of its overseas channels. Their Spanish language channel no longer has Impact listed on their schedule. It was airing Saturdays at 1 p.m. That is no more. It has been replaced by something completely different. It was also pulled from Romania and Finland on Eurosport, which is owned by Discovery, and also pulled from whatever channel it was airing on in Italy. So the writing is on the wall here. They may only have a month left on TV here in the States, unless something changes between now and then. It's not looking too good. Ring of Honor on Destination America is still chugging along. I caught the show this week. Open with the Bloodhound Warriors. Red Scorpion and Grey Wolf. They look like a team straight out of Vince McMahon's company in the 1980s. Big, jacked up dudes, face paint. They look like the powers of pain reincarnated. I've never heard of these guys before. I've never seen them before. But I will say, awesome name. Bloodhound Warriors is an awesome name. Red Scorpion, Grey Wolf. They sound like something out of a Mortal Kombat game, but I like it. I like it. I've never seen them before. I didn't expect them to come walking out on a Ring of Honor show. They took on the Briscoes. We had the Briscoes winning when Jay basically hit the Rainmaker on, I think it was Scorpion. Not to be confused with Mortal Kombat Scorpion. His name was Scorpion, but he was not wearing a yellow outfit, nor did he chuck spears at people. But the Briscoes got the win. After the match, Adam Page came out with Colby Carino and BJ Whitmer. They stood at the top of the stage. Adam Page was talking trash to Jay Briscoe. Jay Briscoe acted like he didn't know who Adam Page was. One thing led to another. They're going to have a match. Roderick Strong beat Donovan Dijak of the House of Truth with the sick kick. Good match. Dijak, he looked good here. I haven't seen too much of him. But here he looked good. Big guy, too. I mean, got to be... I mean, I'm terrible at this, but if I had a guess, every bit of 6'5", 6'6". Jay Lethal ran out after the match to attack Roddy. It turned into a gang attack by the House of Truth until War Machine made the save. Another cool tag team name. Jay Lethal will defend his TV title this Wednesday on ROH TV against Hanson of War Machine. And the main event was the reunited, for 1 week anyway, team of Future Shock, Kyle O'Reilly and Adam Cole, against Christopher Daniels and Frankie Kazarian, The Addiction, for their Ring of Honor tag team titles. Chris Sabin, who is with Daniels and Kazarian, sat in on commentary for the match. Sabin denied that his career was over due to a neck injury. He said that he has super mutant healing powers. It's funny, John Cena has the same thing. Matt Taven, Mike Bennett, and Maria came out late in the match to distract Kyle O'Reilly, which did not sit well with Adam Cole, who is teammates with them, despite their issues of late. So Adam Cole went after Maria. That left Kyle O'Reilly all by himself. He fell victim to the celebrity rehab finish, and the Addiction retained their tag team titles. They all attacked O'Reilly after the bell. Bobby Fish came out to make the save for his tag team partner. The Young Bucks then came out. Last week, they were left for dead by these guys at the end of the show. This time, they were the ones standing tall. Super kicks for the bad guys. And the Young Bucks will get a crack at the tag team titles in 2 weeks. And that was it. I feel like the Destination America version is just a stripped-down version of the Sinclair version of the show that aired. I know, like, at the very least, there's a segment called This Week in ROH that if you watch the Sinclair version, those people apparently get it. It's almost, from what I've read, it's kind of like the closest thing to the old school Event Center with Mean Gene or Sean Mooney. We don't get that segment on the Destination America version. It makes me wonder what else we're not getting, because it's a pretty Yeah, it's a pretty bare-bones show when you really look at it. Not a bad show, but I feel like we're kind of being cheated with the version that we get here on Destination America. Let's jump right into the mailbag. I have a lot of questions from you guys this week. I'm going to try to get to as many of these as I possibly can. If you have emails, you can send them to thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from. Ron from Pittsburgh. What are your thoughts on Zara Schreiber posting photos of swastikas on her Instagram page? Okay, so here's the deal with this. This just became a story last night. So we don't even know what the fallout may or may not be from this. But here's what happened. So Zara, I believe is how you pronounce her name. She is the side chick that Seth Rollins was sending dick pics to. And Rollins now is apparently with her, because one of the funniest parts of TakeOver last week, remember I said they were showing shots of all the big stars sitting at ringside? They showed Seth Rollins sitting with Zara Schreiber. So apparently the two of them are together. I guess Rollins' fiance is no longer with him, and he now has the side woman as his only woman. So I thought that was very funny that they would put them on camera like that. She has been signed with NXT for a while. She has not showed up on TV. Actually, last Saturday would have been the first time I think we've seen her on TV. Cage Side Seats broke the story that somebody, I don't know if it was a random fan who sent it into them and they broke the story, or if it was somebody affiliated with the website, but some fans went and found old Instagram posts from 3 years ago. So this is not something that she posted last weekend. This was something that has been up there for a few years, but you know, 3 years is not that long ago. And they were photos of, I guess, what would have been her apartment, her bedroom at the time. And there was an Iron Eagle with a swastika up on the wall. And there was some lights, and there was a photo of, I forgot the woman's name. But there was the big issue was that there was a swastika up on her wall. And then you see in the screen cap that this person took, because once this came out, she deleted the posts. You know, if she had nothing to hide, why delete it? But she deleted all this stuff. So this stuff is gone, but not before people took some screenshots. In the screenshot, you can see some people taking her to task in the comments, and she's responding back to them by saying, well, you know, this, I like history. And the swastika was around long before Hitler turned it into an icon, which is true. And she told people, you know, fuck off and all this other stuff. It's my page and I'll post whatever I want to. A week after that, she posted another image. This was an illustration of a pony that had a Hitler mustache. It had the swastika armband, but it also had a Hitler mustache. So for all this talk about how, well, you know, the swastika was around long before Hitler, and that's not why I posted it, a week later, she posts a pony with a Hitler mustache. So she's full of shit. You know, here's the deal with this. She's entitled to post whatever she wants to on her own social media accounts. But I think, I don't know how old she is. She's probably very young, maybe early 20s. I don't know her age, her exact age. But I think this is part of the problem with people this young who kind of grow up on social media, or grew up, you know, in their teens or whatever, knowing of Facebook or Twitter or whatever. I mean, this is not all new stuff, right? Social media is not necessarily a new thing. Is that it's so easy. They post everything on there. Every photo, every selfie, every photo, every quote, every joke. They just put it up on social media. And the photos are the biggest problem. And they pay no attention to the fact that once you post something online, it's there forever. Even if you turn around and you delete it, it is retrievable. Once it's online, it is out there for the world to see. And that's fine if you want to post pictures of a swastika or an Iron Eagle or whatever, or a pony with a Hitler mustache. If you find that funny and you want to post it online, go for it. But WWE, I don't know how they're going to react. I guess we're going to find out how much pull Seth Rollins has here. I don't know how they're going to react. They may do nothing. They may put out a statement. They may fire her. The ironic thing is, so this broke last night. Last night, she made her debut at an NXT house show as the sister of Solomon Crowe. So the same night, the same day that this broke, she actually made her debut on an NXT show. And poor Solomon Crowe, this fucker can't catch a break. So I kind of feel bad for him. I don't know what the fallout's going to be. Like I said, they may do nothing. They may have a little talk with her and tell her to be more mindful of what she posts and ask her point blank, is there anything else that's going to come up that we should know about? I don't know that they're actually going to take the step of firing her. They probably should. She seems like she's not worth all the trouble that she's caused. But this is a big problem for a lot of people like her, a lot of younger people who don't have any concept of there being a world without Facebook and without Instagram and Twitter and whatever else. And they just post everything on there and they don't pay any attention to the fact that one day when they get older, they're going to want to be a professional. They're going to want to be an athlete. They're going to want to be a celebrity. They're going to want to be a singer. They're going to be in the public eye. And all of that shit that you post online is going to come back to haunt you. And once it's out there and once it's public, you lose all of your rights and privileges to complain when people make a big stink about the fact that you put a picture of a fucking swastika up on your Instagram page. You lose that privilege to bitch and moan and complain and play the victim here. You know, let that be a lesson. If you want to grow up one day to be president of the United States, if you want to grow up one day to be a politician or a celebrity, or not even necessarily a celebrity, but just a very successful professional at whatever you do, be a little more mindful of the photos and the stupid shit that you post on social media. Please. Okay, keep that in mind. I know we have a lot of younger people listening to the show. Be very mindful of what you put online, because once it's there, you can't get rid of it. Sky from Charlotte. I always hear about how Rock and Austin kept the coveted Attitude Era intact, but Mick Foley rarely gets a mention, even before the Attitude Era was born. He had one of the best debuts against The Undertaker, not to mention the numerous quality matches with Taker, Michaels, and Austin. For me, it's what he did in back-to-back Royal Rumbles for Rock in 99 and Triple H in 2000 that cemented him in the conversation. Is there a reason why Foley is not mentioned as much as the others? And also, which Royal Rumble match is better, Rock in 99 or Triple H in 2000? I think Foley kind of falls through the cracks, maybe. I don't know if that's the best way to put it, but Foley was never a megastar. So when you say, you mentioned Rock and Austin, yeah, of course Foley's not going to be in that conversation. Undertaker is not in that conversation. If you're talking mega, mega stars, like top guys, Mick Foley was not that guy. Austin was, Rock was, Hogan was, Cena is. Foley doesn't get to that level. They never built a brand. They never built the company around Mick Foley. They put the title on him three times, but so what? You know, he wasn't the guy that you build around. So I think that's why he doesn't get as much attention. But, I mean, when people talk about the Attitude Era, I hear his name mentioned plenty of times. It's usually Austin, Rock, Vince, Undertaker, Mankind, and Triple H. I think those are the people, generally speaking, that people talk about. So, you know, I certainly think he belongs in that conversation. Now, you mentioned the performances against Rock and Triple H and what he did to put them over. He deserves a lot of credit for that. And you asked me, which Royal Rumble match is better? Was it the I Quit match with The Rock, or was it the match of Triple H? I mean, the match of Triple H by far. By far, as a match, just so much better. Rock and Mankind was more of a spectacle, and frankly, that's a match, it's very difficult for me to go back and watch that match. That was a match that was tough for me to watch when it happened, let alone all the stuff now. You know, they don't even do chair shots to the head anymore. I don't even think I could go back and watch that, to be honest with you. I have no interest in going back and watching that match. It's just very uncomfortable. And as a match, I don't see how anybody could think, well, I mean, whatever, people have their opinions, they're entitled to it, but to me, Rock and Triple H is easily a better match. And what he did was, it was also much more of a star-making performance than the match with Rock. Rock was going to be a star no matter what. Rock was already a star. Rock was already well on his way. I never looked at the match with Rock as being, well, that's the match that made The Rock, but the match with Triple H at MSG... That's exactly how I viewed that match. That match made Triple H into a main eventer that you can believe in. I didn't take the guy seriously as a main eventer before that. When that match was over, I did. And that, to me, is the biggest difference between the two matches. Not to mention, I just think it's a much better match. Tony from Houston. Had the Iron Sheik did the job for Vern Gagne that Vern asked him to and broke Hulk Hogan's leg in that title match at MSG, who do you think Vince would have gone with as the guy? I still think it would have been Hogan. You know, he would have waited for him to heal up and then pushed him to the moon. I don't think it would have really changed anything at all. It would have just delayed things a little bit, but I don't really think it would have changed the ultimate outcome. Josh from Victorville. I'm watching the episodes of Raw when Daniel Bryan joined and then turned on the Wyatt family. It was short-lived, and I've heard you say on your show before that they cut the angle short. Do you know how long they had originally planned for him to be in the family? I don't know. But I know that Bryan was hoping it would go through WrestleMania. He talked about that in his book. He was hoping it would go through WrestleMania, and that after that, he would break away from the Wyatt family and feud with them. And his rationale, and it's smart, his rationale was he knows they didn't have any plans for him at WrestleMania that year. Or at least to his knowledge, they didn't have any meaningful plan for him at WrestleMania. But he knew they had plans for the Wyatt family, and he knew that Wyatt was going to feud with John Cena, and he was going to have a match, you know, pretty high up on the card. And so, in his mind, if he stayed associated with the Wyatt family, he figured he would have a good spot on the WrestleMania card. As it turned out, he ended up with a really good spot on the WrestleMania card that year, but it had nothing to do with the Wyatt family. All right, let's see here. When Batista left WWE in 2010, although he was a heel, he was one of the top stars in the company and the fans loved him. It was amazing to fast forward 4 years later and how the fans just did not seem to care about him at all. Where do you think WWE went wrong in booking him? And if you were running the show, how would you have handled his return? The guy was toast the minute he walked out for that Royal Rumble match. Once people realized that Bryan wasn't coming out, it was over. You know, then Batista won it, his first match back, wins the Royal Rumble, and the people just shat all over it. He should not have been a heel. I would have had Bryan win the Royal Rumble, and then Batista makes a surprise return on Raw the night after as a hired hand of the Authority, and he beats the snot out of Bryan. They then have a match at the Elimination Chamber, not for the title shot at Mania. I hate when they do that. Just the match, and Batista wins. That same night, I would have somehow gotten Brock Lesnar into that championship chamber match and had him win the WWE title. Now you've got Daniel Bryan against Brock Lesnar for the championship at WrestleMania 30. The ultimate David versus Goliath match. Plus, Bryan just lost to Batista. Now what that does is it plants the seeds of doubt about this guy's chances against this monster at WrestleMania. That's the story they can build heading into the show. But it also does a couple of other things. It gives Batista a big win in his first big singles match. You don't want to beat him in his first match back, so he beats Bryan. Which is good. It's good that he gets the win, because I'd have done Batista versus Undertaker at WrestleMania 30. You know, they had a pretty good match at WrestleMania 23. I don't know that this one would be as good, but there's a history there. So do Batista, Taker, or WrestleMania instead. Batista loses. I would not have broke the streak. Bryan beats Brock to win the title in the main event. And because Batista had that win over Bryan in February, now he can say that he deserves a championship match, and he can feud with Bryan for the next couple of months and put Bryan over before he leaves to go film a movie, which is exactly what he did. And you could still put Brock over strong for the title at SummerSlam. You could put the belt right back on him at SummerSlam, and Brock goes on to be a monster heel champion. You know, it doesn't have to change the long term of what ended up happening. You still kind of get to that same result, which is put the belt on Brock and just let him go on a tear. That's how I would have done it. Bryan wins the Rumble. Batista comes back the night after as a heel, beats him up. That was the role for him to be in. And eventually the fans would have turned him babyface anyway. But they made him a babyface right out of the gate. And again, because of what was going on with Bryan, it wasn't really Batista's fault, but the guy got fucked over because of it. So I would not have brought him in that night, and I would have brought him in as a heel. Kent from Philadelphia. Alex Wright, did you think he was talented and did not really get a chance to reach his true potential? I personally think that also, the Disco Inferno was one of the funniest wrestling personalities of all time. What are your thoughts on Alex Wright and Disco Inferno? Yeah, you know, Alex Wright's a weird one because he had a great look. You know, like, you know, he's a good-looking guy, and the girls would scream when he would come out, and he would do his little dance, his very goofy dance. And he wasn't a bad wrestler. So I thought they had big plans for this guy. I mean, pushing young guys like that was not exactly their strong suit at the time, with Hogan and Savage and those kind of guys on top. Maybe if he was in WWE, Vince would have done something more with him. I mean, there's no way to know for sure. Yeah, I think there was a lot of potential there. It kind of got squandered. I mean, he had that look. You could market him as being this big, you know, this big deal to all the girls, and I don't know. They didn't really do much with him. And then I think he got hurt, and he came back, and he had a shaved head, and they changed his name. He was done. He was done for at that point. As far as Disco Inferno, I know guys that worked with him thought he was a funny guy behind the scenes, and he would always crack people up. And that may well be the case, you know, behind the scenes. But the best thing I can say about Disco Inferno, I liked his theme song. To me, that's really all he was. He was a theme song. Other than that, he was a joke, and I just don't think very highly of the guy. Matt from St. Louis. The worst blade job I've ever seen was Vince McMahon at Survivor Series 2003 against The Undertaker. What is the bloodiest blade job you can recall? I am inclined to agree with you. You kind of took my answer there. That was disgusting. And what's worse about that, it happened in like the first 2 minutes of the match. He still had an entire match to go, and he bled the whole way through. I can't even imagine how much blood he lost in that match. The other one that comes to mind, so it may be a tie, because this is up there, is Eddie Guerrero in that first match with JBL at Judgment Day in 2004, when JBL hit him in the head with that chair. I know some people think that was hard way. It wasn't. He cut himself. It was pretty obvious he cut himself. And he must have hit an artery, because he was losing pints of blood. I don't know how he was even able to stand up. And when he got back in the ring, so the match is already over, but he got back in the ring and they did some more stuff. JBL was also bleeding. He was begging off. By the time this whole thing was over, the entire mat, it was almost a red mat. That's how saturated in blood the ring mat was. I think they rushed Eddie to the hospital after the show because he went into shock from all the blood loss. This guy almost died just to get JBL over. That tells you the kind of person that Eddie Guerrero was. I mean, I know he was friendly with JBL. He wanted to help him. This was when JBL had just, literally just weeks earlier, walked out on TV playing a completely different character, and they said, okay, we're going to get this guy over as a world title contender, which is not an easy thing to do when this guy has been branded a certain way and he's been part of a tag team his whole career. But Eddie was bound and determined to help get this guy over, and he almost died doing so on that show. So to me, those are probably the sickest blade jobs I've ever seen. Daryl from Windsor, Ontario, Canada. Two-part question. Firstly, why isn't Natalya part of this Divas Revolution? With her wrestling ability, she'd be a no-brainer to be involved. Secondly, and hopefully when Tyson Kidd returns, if and when he returns, do he and Cesaro reunite as a tag team? Or because of Cesaro's most successful singles run recently, do they feud with one another? I would assume that she's been given time off just to kind of take care of him with his injury. I don't know that for sure. I just kind of assumed that was the reason. And if Cesaro's still getting a singles push when Tyson Kidd comes back, you keep it going. You don't just put the guy back in a tag team. You know, then what you could do, you could have Tyson turn on him after a while because he feels betrayed, and they can build a feud up. It'd be nice for Tyson Kidd to get a little push as a singles heel on the main roster. I was a big fan of the stuff with him and Natalya. You know, for a while on NXT, Tyson Kidd was getting this big singles push. He was headlining against Neville and Zayn and getting championship matches. He was tearing it up. And they never really took full advantage of that on the main roster. So maybe that would be the best for both of them. If Cesaro's still getting a push, Tyson Kidd comes back. You know what they could do? They could reunite them as a team. And in that match, Tyson turns on him. And then it turns into a singles feud. I'd be in favor of that idea. Damon, this might be a pretty loaded question, but there's this game called Cherish, Keep, Borrow, Sell. It's like a version of Marry, Fuck, Kill, but with one other option. That being said, which of these Kurt Angles would you cherish, keep, borrow, and sell. Kurt Angle with hair, bald Kurt Angle, ECW Kurt Angle, or TNA Impact Kurt Angle? Well, I gave this some thought, and I thought this was going to be a lot harder than it was, but I came up with this in about 30 seconds. I would cherish Kurt Angle with hair. To me, there will never be a better Kurt Angle than Kurt Angle with hair back in 2000 and 2001. One of the greatest things I've ever seen is Kurt Angle standing in the middle of the ring with a condom in his hand, telling the Godfather it would be a good idea for him to start using one of these. It's just awesome. Awesome. And that was just one of many funny things that Kurt did in that original run. The guy was hilarious. I mean, the same for when he did the comedy stuff with Austin during the invasion. One of the few things I liked about that invasion. The guy was just fantastic. And it wasn't like he was funny but not that good in the ring and still green. Kurt Angle was very good from day one. And even in that original run, he had great matches. I mean, he had more kind of classic, iconic matches later on when he was more serious. But he was having good matches. He was in the prime of his physical prime. He was one of the funniest guys I've ever seen on a wrestling show. He was awesome. So I would cherish Kurt Angle with hair. I would keep bald Kurt Angle after Edge shaved him bald. Which was also funny. He wore that headgear for a while. He had great matches during that period. I mean, one of the greatest matches in WWE history, and it's a shame you'll never hear about it again, was the championship match with him and Chris Benoit at the Royal Rumble in 2003. That was during the so-called bald Kurt Angle phase. He had great match after great match after great match. Team Angle, the stuff with Haas and Benjamin was during that period. His matches with Brock Lesnar was during that period. So I would keep bald Kurt. I would borrow TNA Impact Kurt, because you say what you want about TNA. Especially earlier on in his run, Kurt was a machine in that company. I mean, it's kind of sad to watch now because you know how beat up he is and he's kind of nearing the end of his rope. But at the beginning, I mean, the matches with Samoa Joe and AJ Styles, he had some kick-ass matches in TNA that, regardless of what you think about TNA, you can't ignore those matches. So, but at the same time, he was also never, you know, as big of a star just by virtue of where he was. So I think that's why people kind of dismiss it or they don't think about it. But I would borrow TNA Kurt Angle and I would sell ECW Kurt Angle. ECW Kurt Angle was only like a couple of months. It didn't last very long. He was gone from the company almost right after it started. Yeah, it was kind of cool seeing him out there with that mouthpiece. He looked very menacing. It was more of a serious Kurt Angle. There was no comedy involved at all. So it wasn't bad. I'm not saying it was a bad version of Kurt. You know, he was this ass-kicking wrestling machine. I mean, what's not to like? But of all the iterations of Kurt Angle, that was probably my least favorite. And it didn't last very long anyway. So I would sell ECW Kurt Angle. Tay from DC. My question is about 2001 and Eric Bischoff's plan to relaunch WCW after the proposed Big Bang pay-per-view. You said that it didn't happen because he lost TV, but if Bischoff would have shopped around more to networks like ESPN, NBC, or Fox Sports... Was Fox Sports even a thing back then? I don't even know if Fox Sports was around. It may have been. Do you think WCW could have survived? No. I don't. Who's to say he didn't? Who's to say that Bischoff didn't try to get a meeting with somebody at ESPN or NBC? You know, it wouldn't have mattered because WCW was such a poisoned, damaged brand at that point. Who would have wanted it? You know, who would have bid for it? Who would have wanted to take it on? And even if they did, I don't think it would have lasted. I mean, at most, maybe a couple of years, but it's not as though WCW would still be around today. I don't believe for a second that WCW would be around today. Jeremy from Missouri. If only one thing could have happened, which would you rather have? Vince McMahon becoming the evil owner or the NWO forming? Not which one had a bigger impact, but which one would you personally still want to have had happen? Vince the evil owner. I was a WWF guy. way more than I was a WCW guy back then. My friend was more of a WCW fan, and we would have passionate, like, two-hour-long debates after class about why Raw was better or why Nitro was better and Raw sucked. We were very passionate in our positions. But we would both flip. It's not like I never watched any WCW. I would flip between commercials, and I would flip when Raw went off the air. So I knew what was going on, and you know, some of the stuff was very cool. You know, it was exciting to see the NWO at the beginning, and you thought they were taking over and all that stuff. But the NWO, it got old real quick when they started to add guys to it, and it turned into the same shit every week with those beatdowns at the end of every single show. To me, the Austin McMahon stuff was a lot more fun. You know, at least with Austin and Vince, they tried to change it up week to week. And as over and as popular as Austin was, it was a lot of fun to see him come out and, you know, jump off a Zamboni or climb up on top of a beer truck or dress up as a doctor and beat the piss out of McMahon with a bedpan. You know, that was, to me, that was a lot more entertaining. The NWO shtick, it just got old after a while. Mario, did you hear what Kevin Castle said about you on his show this week? Yes, I did. I saw that clip. I saw the clip posted on our Facebook page. That was very nice of him to say. He was very cool. The respect is mutual, so that means a lot. Michael from Bonita Springs, Florida. Buy or sell the Dudley Boys run in ECW and TNA or the Dudley Boys run in WWE? Singles and tag team runs are included for both, he says. If we're counting singles runs, I'm buying ECW and TNA, and I'm selling on WWE. The Dudleys, and Bubba in particular, were such great heels in ECW. They would never, ever get away with that stuff today in WWE. It just wouldn't happen. Maybe in Lucha Underground. You know, I could see the Dudleys of old doing their thing in Lucha Underground, and it, I mean, that would probably work. And Bubba as Bully Ray in TNA, he completely reinvented himself, and he proved that he could hack it on his own. And there were a lot of people, I'm sure, who didn't think he could, because he only got older, you know, and it's not like he was in the best of shape, but he lost all that weight, he changed his whole look, his promo style, everything. You know, he became a character all on his own, and people weren't clamoring all of a sudden for a Dudley Boys reunion every week. He was Bully Ray the heel, and people, it worked. They accepted it for what it was, and he was very good in that role. I can't sit here and say the guy was money in TNA, because money and TNA are two things that don't go together. I mean, let's be honest. Nobody, except maybe Jeff Hardy, for a period of time, was really ever a draw, like a money draw in TNA. Look at all the big names they brought in. Hogan, Flair, Sting, Angle. I mean, go down the whole list. And Kurt Angle was very important to TNA, again, for a period of time. After a while, he wasn't special anymore. Jeff Hardy, you know, I used to read about how much merchandise he was selling, and he was a huge pickup for TNA and a big loss for WWE. If they could, WWE would have snatched him back up. I'm sure they'd love to have him back now, too. But nobody was ever really a draw in TNA. TNA was the place that your career, you know, you came to die. That's just how it was. And a lot of those guys ended up going right back to WWE. But between the heel Dudley's run in ECW and the Bully Ray run in TNA, I'm buying on that. I think it could work now, too, but WWE doesn't have the guts to let him be, you know, as bad as he could be. You know, not now. I'm talking once this little Dudley's nostalgia revival has run its course. Down the road, I'd love to see them give him a shot, but I don't think they'll ever do it. And Jesse from Jamaica, Queens. Buy or sell? Paul Heyman the promoter or Paul Heyman the advocate? Oh boy. you're really coming at me with these things, aren't you? Yeah, look, it's hard for me to say I'm selling on Paul Heyman, the promoter. I don't think there is a better self-promoter in wrestling than Paul Heyman. He's fantastic. at it, obviously, and you know, the stories of him in ECW being a good promoter but a bad businessman. I'm sure there's a lot of truth to that. And you can't deny the success that he had with ECW. To this day, you still get people chanting ECW. To this day, you know, the influence of ECW is still felt on wrestling today. WWE, TNA, you know, you could trace all that back to ECW. So he definitely had an impact, and I don't doubt that if Paul Heyman wanted to start his own wrestling promotion, he'd probably do very well at it. But I can't put Paul Heyman, the promoter, over Paul Heyman, the TV character and the promo. So I'm going to buy on Heyman. Yeah, let's be honest. The advocate. That's just a fancy word for saying manager. So when you say that, I'm not just taking the stuff with Brock. I'm taking the stuff with Brock. I'm taking Heyman on TV back during the invasion in 01. I'm even taking some of Heyman back when he was Paulie Dangerously. I'm looking at his whole body of work as an on-air performer, and I'm saying to myself that there have been few, you know, if anyone, who has been better at that than him. To me, you know, him and Bobby Heenan, they're neck and neck right there, and I'm the biggest Bobby Heenan fan you'll find. But it's very hard for me to sit here and say that Paul Heyman isn't as good as Bobby Heenan. I think they're in the same stratosphere. I think the two of them are up there together. As an on-air performer, I'm buying. I'm buying on him as an advocate, as you say, and I'm selling on him as a promoter, not because I don't think he'd be good, but because I think he's much, much better as a performer on TV. You know, and I'd hate for him to be off TV and be behind the scenes doing stuff and not being on TV anymore. He's one of the shining lights on that Raw show. The guy comes out every single week and somehow he manages to top himself. All he's doing is coming out and saying the same stuff week after week, right? He's saying the same stuff about Brock, my client, but somehow he keeps the people into it. And by the end, he has people giving him a fucking standing ovation week after week. I mean, there's no better performer, I think, right now on TV in all of wrestling than Paul Heyman. So I got to go. It's a tough one, but I got to go with Heyman the Advocate. I am I'm buying all day long on that. Sad tweet this week. You know, I don't know how many of you heard about the whole Darren Young thing. I knew a little bit about it, and I looked it up. And so what happened is last week, I guess Darren Young, he posted a series of tweets. He was very upset because a cameraman for Total Divas, who I don't know, maybe he may work for WWE, apparently came on to him. And through social media, you know, in private, in like a private message, he sent Darren Young a topless photo of himself. He took like a topless selfie. And he was clearly trying to come on to Darren Young. And Darren Young was like, dude, this is inappropriate. And, you know, I'm in a relationship and you're trying to wreck this relationship and this isn't right. And the guy wrote back. He was like, you're right. I'm sorry. I apologize. It was completely inappropriate. For some reason, Darren Young decided to go and out this guy on Twitter. And he posted all these tweets. He posted screen caps of the conversation, including a screen cap of the topless photo that the guy posted. So, you know, I don't know if the guy, I guess the guy must be gay. I don't know if he's out amongst his friends and family. I mean, but he put it out there. Darren Young put this out there in public for all to see. And he was pissed off that somebody was trying to wreck, you know, his relationship. And you have to just stay strong and don't let people ruin your home life and all this stuff. And I'm just thinking to myself, what the fuck is wrong with this guy? Why are you posting this on Twitter? Now, this goes to what I was saying earlier about people who post stupid shit on Twitter that they shouldn't be posting. I mean, I'm not saying it's right what the guy did, but the guy admitted, yeah, I made a mistake. I'm sorry. I fucked up. And that's the end of it. Now, if the guy continues to harass you, you have every right to go to your employer and say, listen, this guy works for the show, or he works for the company. This is the second time now. I told him the first time, I'm not interested. Leave me alone. Stop harassing me. He did it again. I wanted to bring it to your attention. That would be the normal thing to do. No, his first inclination is to post all of this stuff in public online for everybody to see. So now this other guy, I don't know if this guy may lose his job or if this ruins his life. It didn't seem like what the guy did warranted this kind of response. But Darren Young thinks he's being a champion. This is the right thing to do. I just looked at this and I said, this is like cyberbullying. You know, Darren Young is one of the guys they send around to the Be A Star rallies to rail against bullying. And the fucking guy doesn't even realize that he just cyberbullied someone online. So I'm not even going to read all the tweets. I mean, I'm sure they're still up. I don't think he deleted them. You could probably go back and find them. But that's my impression of the whole story. I'm not saying what the guy did was right. You know what? You know, don't start sending half naked pictures of yourself to your coworkers, especially when you know that coworker is in a relationship that's kind of fucked up. But it didn't warrant him airing out all this dirty laundry on Twitter. I thought what Darren Young did, frankly, was more fucked up than what this other guy did. Darren Young, I don't know. Some of the things that he goes online and he says, I have a lot of respect for him because he speaks his mind, but I almost feel like he feels he's bulletproof, for obvious reasons, and he needs to be careful, because one of these days he's going to say the wrong thing, and that's going to be the end of him, regardless of his story or his sexual orientation, and this, I think, was just going too far. One last thing here before we wrap up I thought was kind of interesting. The Oxford Dictionary has added a few new words this past week. Among them, butthurt, which pretty much describes all of the internet, about everything. MacGyver, which hasn't been on the air for over 20 years, but was a great show when it was. Great theme song, too. Only MacGyver could disarm a bomb using nothing more than a paperclip and a stick of gum. And now it's a verb. Maybe we can get MacGyver to fix this Divas Revolution. Hoverboard has been added to the dictionary. Any Back to the Future fans will know what that is. Part 2, still my favorite of the series. It was the year 2015 in that movie when we saw the hoverboard. Now it's 2015 in real life and still no hoverboard. Very disappointing. And guess what other word has been added to the dictionary? Kayfabe. And this is how they define it. It is defined in professional wrestling, it says, as the fact or convention of presenting staged performances as genuine or authentic. I'm not even sure that's the right definition. Kayfabe, it's kind of like, I guess it's kind of like the right definition, but, like talking carny and all that kind of stuff, that also goes into it. It goes back to the carnivals, but anyway, it says, it gives some examples. It says, he's not someone who can break kayfabe and talk about the business. I heard AJ approached him to rehearse a kayfabe segment. So anyway, there you go. Oxford has broken kayfabe by defining kayfabe. It says, while its origin is uncertain, it's often said to have arisen in American traveling carnivals. One explanation interprets the word as an alteration of be fake written backwards, while the AY element in kayfabe is typical of the way in which words are formed in Pig Latin. Uh-oh. Don't go telling people that the whole basis of the word kayfabe is steeped in the word fake. The dreaded F word. People on Twitter may get all butthurt about it. If you have questions for the mailbag, thesolomonster@gmail.com is the place to send any and all correspondence. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. You can follow me on Twitter, @Solomonster. And you could also subscribe to our YouTube channel. All the Sound Off extras, including the SummerSlam review, NXT Brooklyn review, they're all up there. YouTube.com/TheSolomonster. And you can hit the subscribe button while you are there. Again, head on over to WrestlingSoup.com. Check out the show I did with Mission Joey yesterday. We had a lot of fun. We'll do more of them in the future. So WrestlingSoup.com or @WrestlingSoup on Twitter is their handle. We will be back next weekend for episode 399. We're getting close. I'll be honest, I don't have anything special planned for the 400th episode. I'm giving it some thought, but, we'll see what happens. It's just, I think the best thing I could do is just keep doing the show that everybody, looks forward to every week. I don't think anybody would want a different version of the podcast. So I don't want to get anybody's hopes up. But that is a big milestone. I am looking forward to doing that. It's very cool. But first, we got $3.99. That'll be next weekend, Labor Day weekend. So until then, be well, stay safe, enjoy the final days of August here as we head into the month of September. And we will see you right back here for a brand new podcast next weekend. Until then, take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the Ugly. The Sala Monster sounds off.
Watch these promos on NXT. Watch Raw. Watch a Randy Orton promo or a Sheamus promo. They never, ever look at the camera. It's because that's what they teach them now. You are not allowed to look into the camera. I think it's just completely idiotic. Why are their eyes not on me? That's how interviews always work. They're talking to me. They're speaking to us. They're supposed to be speaking to the fans. Maybe that's part of the reason why these people can't make a connection with the audience. Because they don't fucking look at us.
Since 2007, The Sala Monster Sounds Off. Available at thesalamonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solo Monsters Sound Off.